you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, you know, a lot of people say that economics is the dull science. And I've got to tell you, I didn't take that many economics courses in college. I took a few and I thought they were interesting. I really did. Maybe it's the professor, because I think that really tells you a lot.
Well, that's what really makes the world go around, right? Economics. I mean, it's
supply and demand. Right, what exactly. Else do we need to know, John? Thank you. I'm now an economist. No, but seriously, you think about economy and you think about the economists, and it's said that if you have 100 economists in one room, you probably will have about 101 different opinions as to what they see with the numbers. But the numbers are really so interesting, because we hear certain numbers, and you're going to hear a lot of them during the campaign that's coming up. And you're going to hear somebody say, well, we have low unemployment. But then you're going to hear somebody say, yeah, but the job quality isn't good, or the wages associated with those jobs isn't great. And then, of course, they'll tell you, oh, by the way, I know you've got a number, but that number doesn't include people who stop looking for a job. And in fact, the job participation rate in America is still lower than it was before the recession of 2008.
Wait, you're absolutely, and that's the whole problem with economics. It depends on who's doing the counting and what they're counting.
Yeah, and what kind of green eye shade they're wearing.
But because they can make it sound so much better if we don't count this or that.
Right. Well, I mean, I've never understood that notion that, well, if they stop looking for a job, then we don't put them in the numbers. But if they start going back and hinting and they go up on one of these Indeed.com or whatever, ah, we found you. You're back. Yeah. And so now we're going to count you as one of the unemployed looking for work. So, right. I mean, when you hear that number, 3.7%, John, to me, I would feel it more. I mean, if I really thought this economy that we're in is roaring, I don't sense that. I mean, I do see in our community dollar stores thriving, but department stores failing.
Well, part of the problem for us, though, and here's the problem, we're in a state that hasn't really
come out,
caught up with everybody else. So I don't, and I can't speak for everybody else, but I know the state we're in is not very business friendly. So I don't know whether
but we are also, ironically, one of the highest per capita income states in the country. We're talking about Connecticut. So, but one of the things that I really
go figure that now. There's some figures.
I know. Go figure. But David Blanchflower is going to help us through this. He's a professor at Dartmouth. He's written a book called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? That was a
I've
song.
I've been to Dartmouth.
For you young people. You what?
I've been to Dartmouth.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And?
Yeah, well, it's a nice place.
Did you get accepted there? Or did you just drive by?
No, actually, I worked at Dartmouth for a while when I was a kid. Yeah, my dad was a teacher up there.
Really?
For a short time, yeah.
In Hanover,
New Hampshire? Yeah, we lived up there for 2 years.
Wow, John, I never realized that. What was your father there?
He was a French teacher up there, but he would teach summers. It was for what was that called now? Where they'd send kids overseas.
Our exchange program.
Yeah, so he would teach kids French to go work in.
Oh, really? Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. See, I'm learning things about John.
I've been to Dartmouth. I'm so much smarter.
Yeah, you absolutely. you took in a lot of heavy thunk.
I did. That's beautiful really good. Buildings.
Well, the fact is that this podcast really talks about the importance of economists looking around and talking to real people, because they can get mired in all of the numbers, but there's also a certain art to the economy and understanding when somebody says, I think we're going to go into a recession because consumer confidence is flagging. Well, how do you know consumer confidence is flagging? Now, you can do qualitative studies. You can interview people. Will you make a big item purchase in the next 3 months? Oh, no, I'm saving it because I have to buy Christmas gifts, whatever it may be. So he believes that you can learn a lot by walking about, as he calls it, and really beginning to understand the whole ecosystem of the economy, as opposed to just getting buried in GDP and various numbers that overwhelm us often.
And constantly the news is throwing numbers out there, telling us how good things are or how bad things are, but what do they really mean?
Right. What's the context? Exactly. Well, we're going to help you to understand that because you, again, are going to be inundated during the 2020 cycle with numbers. You're going to hear, I think, the Republican Party saying this is our strong suit. And then you're going to hear Democrats saying it's not as good for those who are at the lower end or the middle end as it is for those who really create capital and are in the 1%. So you're going to hear some very interesting arguments. We want to give you the tools with which to really interpret what it is that they're saying. Well, we're doing that today with David here on America Trends.
With us on the line on America Trends is David Blanchflower, and the book is called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? And David, we're having this conversation at a time when the stock market is roaring. The president is telling us that jobs are aplenty. There's never been a better economy in the history of America. So who's right, or what are we missing that he's seeing here?
Well, we're also hearing that the president of the United States has been targeting the Fed and telling them that they need to do rate cuts. And the evidence actually, it's a very good day because yesterday Chairman Powell giving testimony said there's no basis or any evidence for calling this a hot labor market, and admitted that actually they had really misunderstood what's happened in the labor market. So this is really about what's happened over the last decade. We have the Great Recession, and we're 10 years on, and people have been hurting. The number that I would probably get people to look at would be if you looked in 2008 and said, what proportion of adults are working? And then you looked at it today, the answer is about 2.5 percentage points less. So the problem is, in fact, if you think, well, is the Fed supposed to be focusing on maximum employment? That's clearly not where we are. The unemployment rate is pretty low, but the book deals a great deal with the fact that the unemployment rate is no longer a good indicator. And if we really were at full employment and everything was as hot as you suggested, why would so many people be hurting and around the world voting for political parties that really, well, for populist movements around the world? So the book is about the fact that people are not working. It's not as good as everybody suggests. And simply, if you look in the United States, to get the what's called the employment rate, which is just the proportion of adults who are working, back to where we were in 2008, it would take about 6 million additional jobs. So things are not as great as people have suggested. And that's exactly why Trump has been saying that the Fed should cut rates, and the markets are actually pricing in today 3 rate cuts by Christmas. So there's dilemma. The story's pretty different from what a lot of times people have been saying.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of those terms that we often hear. The one that I'd like to focus on for one moment is the participation rate. In your book, you say it's about 62.9%, and some say that there are 93 million adults who are not in the workforce. You say we probably could put another 10 million in very easily, and that the unemployment rate might suggest there are fewer. So we get confused and all bottled up with these numbers.
Well, the numbers in the labor market are kind of confusing. And the reason why, in a way, we're particularly confused now is because before 2008, whatever measure of the labor market you took was really highly correlated with everything else. It didn't really matter which one you looked at. But today, unfortunately, that's not true. So let's go to the participation rate. That's just the proportion of adults who are either employed or unemployed. So the people who aren't part of that are called out of the labor force. And this is a really big puzzle. I mean, what we've seen actually is the participation rate fell dramatically after 2008. It picked up in recent years. But the puzzle actually is that the participation rate in every other country has basically remained flat or risen. So the participation rate is a really big deal. And the problem particularly is that people have become so despondent. They can't find a job. They're not actually calling themselves unemployed. They've been discouraged from working, and they do what we call and leave the labor force. The issue is, if the economy was getting close to full employment, how many of those people would come out of the labor force and to take jobs? And the answer is probably quite a lot. And the big concern about these people who are non-participants is that we've seen a huge rise in their, in their unhappiness. This group particularly are the ones that have been subject to what Deaton and Case called deaths of despair. So the group we really, really need to worry about in the United States are prime age adults, particularly white, especially those with lower levels of education. And we've seen huge rise in suicide rates, disease of the liver, drug overdoses, particularly for that group. And the big deal, and this is true in the UK as well, in the last couple of years, life expectancy in the US has fallen, particularly amongst that group. So non-participation, being separate from the labor force, being separate from work, being discouraged, is really bad. And we've seen a huge rise in depression, isolation, helplessness, anxiety, all these kinds of things. And the book documents that. And I argue basically this is to do with the lack of decent jobs that are available for this group of people. They've become detached from the labor market, and they've become unhappy.
And we are talking in many cases about young white males. I know you talked about some of the work that Nicholas Eberstadt has done in this area, and we've had him on a podcast previously. Do you want to talk about young white males, particularly in the Midwest and rural areas in America?
Well, that group clearly is a concern. I mean, we've seen the rise of overdoses amongst from heroin and so on. I mean, in a way, that group is a concern. I mean, my bigger concern. I mean, that group is right. The prospect for those young people is relatively low. But I would still emphasize, I think that the prime age, perhaps a little bit older than that. Is the group that really is a worry. But of course, these young folks are going to become that group pretty soon. I mean, the big deal as well, actually, for these folks is that it's a bad thing. We know from research in the field that I'm in, labor economics, that it's really bad to be young and come into the labor market when unemployment rates are high, when jobs aren't available. So young people who became 17, 18 or so, between 2007 and now, they've struggled because the labor market has not given them easy access. I mean, the way I like to talk to my students about it is, think of the job pyramid. People start at the bottom and rise up. And if you're a college graduate, you enter at the point where college graduates enter. Well, actually, it turns out that college graduates have had to enter lower down that pyramid, pushing out the least skilled out of the bottom. And what we've seen, and this is a really another big argument to say we're not at full employment, you'd expect to see people starting to rise up that pyramid. And if we were at full employment, then you'd see people who were high school graduates being able to take the job of college graduates because there was such a shortage of workers. So we see none of that. So obviously this group is a problem. And particularly, I think the story in a way in this Great Recession is perhaps we should focus on white, because whites particularly, we've seen this concern, whites are really dominantly the problem in these deaths of despair. And the opioid crisis is really amongst whites, not so much amongst minorities. So obviously this relates to the heartland, rural America, and the places essentially where Trump won the presidency.
All of our senses are tuned to what's really going on. What would we see? Because you say that the macro economists over the years, certainly the last decade, have gotten just about everything wrong. And so we see a lot of people pushing back and rebelling against expertise in our society. But what is it that they're missing by not subscribing to the notion of the economics of walking around?
I mean, if you look back to 2007, 2008, it's really pretty clear that central bankers, policymakers, didn't really see the recession, or if they saw a slowing coming, they had no clue how bad it was. A lot of economists have argued you should never expect economists to spot recessions, which I think is abject nonsense. But actually, one of the big things that happened was that central bankers and policymakers didn't spot the recession 6 to 9 months after it had happened. They still hadn't spotted it. And the answer was, in fact, they were stuck with old models, old ways of thinking, didn't get outside the big cities. So what do I mean by the economics of walking about? Talk to people, listen to what they have to say, listen to individuals, listen to firms. And we're seeing these kinds of data coming out right now. There's a thing called the purchasing manager indices, which are called PMIs, and they just ask people, tell us what's going on. They ask employers, they ask purchasing managers in construction and manufacturing and services, what's going on? And it turns out they give you a pretty darn good idea of what's happening, and you get it within about 2 weeks. And so those data are telling you right now that slowing's coming. The data in 2006 told you that, but these policymakers simply missed it. So they missed the Great Recession. Then we got to 2009 or so after growth started to pick up again, and essentially we saw the unbelievably slow recovery. I mean, the UK is a good example. The UK recovery is the slowest in 300 years. Two that were slower was the South Sea Bubble 300 years ago and the Black Death 600 years ago. So you see this very slow recovery. People are hurting. And now we're in a position where the Fed raised rates, and we now realize that actually the economy is slowing. That was another big error. So you saw an error in 2007 and 8 that people missed the Great Recession. In the recovery, they said everything was going to be great, and it hasn't been. And now it looks like they've missed the downturn again. And we're seeing the Fed in a blind panic over the last few days, realizing that the rate increases that they did, saying that we were at full employment, was completely wrong. And yesterday, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asking Powell yesterday, so you've got it all completely wrong. And basically, Powell said, yeah, we got the labor market wrong. I think we learned that everything was much lower than we thought. Well, that has consequences on ordinary people.
David Blanchflower is with us. The book is called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? And it is important that it be a decent job. I know there are many people who are working, but you point out, and others have as well, that there's this underemployment that's going on, or people with three lousy jobs all at once.
Right.
So what are the quality of jobs that are available, if and when they are available to someone these days?
When I talk about good jobs, and what I mean by good job is something that's stable and secure and provides enough wages or earnings essentially to pay the bills. And we've seen that, particularly for the groups who are less educated, those good jobs that their parents had, their grandparents had, seem to have gone. So yes, employment's up, but the big story why the unemployment rate is really pretty hopeless is that there's this huge amount of underemployment around the world. So that, what I mean by that is, particularly people are stuck in part-time jobs and they'd really like full-time jobs, or even if they're in the part-time job and they're happy to be there, they just want more hours and they can't get them. I mean, we know about people on the minimum wage. Yes, they're on the minimum wage, but oftentimes they simply can't get enough hours to multiply their wage by. If you make $15 an hour and you get 10 hours, that's different than if you get 50. So it turns out that there's that. People are very unhappy about the insecurity that it's brought and the fact that they can't make their incomes high enough. So it turns out what's crucial about underemployment, unlike unemployment, which has gone back to pre-recession levels, underemployment is still way above what it was in 2008. So that tells you that you're not anywhere near full employment, and the Fed and central banks around the world have missed it and haven't understood that this is really the thing that's driving the world now. And underemployment makes people unhappy. It makes them insecure. It makes them anxious. It gives them depression. So the people out there, if you do the economics of walking about, the underemployed are struggling. And if you were at full employment, that's not what you'd see. You'd see firms, if there was a shortage of labor, the first thing you see firms do is say to their workers, would you like to work more hours at the going wage? And they say, sure. So I think it's an intellectual failure, but it's a failure to actually realize that people, even though they have a job, the jobs are crummy, they're not paid enough, they haven't got enough hours, and they're frightened, and they're worried that they'll lose those jobs. That shouldn't be true 10 years into a recovery. So we're 10 years in, and the likelihood is that the economy is about to slow. So this is about as good as it's going to get, and I would argue a lot driven by macro policy failure. And in this context, Trump's probably right to say that the Fed made a terrible error. It's time to cut rates because people are hurting. So in this case, I think he's right.
Could we go back to the Great Recession and put it in text? On this podcast, we've done a lot of reporting on it. Adam Tooze of the book Crashed was with us recently. But I'd love to hear your perspective on why we got it wrong, what we got wrong, and what we haven't gotten right since.
Sure. Well, I'm good to talk about that. I was a member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England. I voted 36 times on interest rates from 2006 to 2009. And I started to vote on my own from October 2007 till basically October 2008. And I kept saying there was a horrible recession coming, and the rest of the people on my committee voted against it, didn't agree, didn't think it was coming. So that was pretty hard for me, and it seemed so blindingly obvious to me. And I think that was a sort of intellectual failure. For me, it's hard to understand why people didn't see it. By April 2008, it was clear in my mind the U.S. was in recession and everywhere else was, and other people on those committees didn't see that. And they've even argued that actually if they had seen it, the world wouldn't have been any different, which I just don't buy. I think the big reason why people say in the U.K. missed it was that they underestimated the importance of what has happened in America. And I think in America, people really missed it because nothing much like this had happened between 1945 and 2007, but they forgot what had happened in the 30s. And in the 30s, we had the Great Crash, followed by the Great Depression, a major financial crisis. And Keynes warned that what would follow the Great Crash would be the long, dragging conditions of semi-slump. And so people basically missed it, and they haven't really understood that since 2008. So this is a huge failure of economics. If you look back now, it's pretty much blindingly obvious. By around 2007, after you've seen, I mean, in the UK, you actually had a bank failure. You had a bank failure in 2007, where there were thousands of people lined up outside a bank for the first time in 100 years. And that was a year before really we central banks started to kind of respond. So it's hard to argue, you know, to justify what happened. And I think that people rightly said, why should we trust these elites who are completely clueless? And essentially, the other thing which I think is a concern is that none of them have really apologized and said, oh, we made a terrible mistake. They simply said, you shouldn't have expected us to see it. And if we had have seen it, it wouldn't have made any difference, which is absolute nonsense. So if you look back, I think that's a major failure of the field of economics. It seemed blindingly obvious to me, which is why I started voting for rate cuts a year ahead of everybody else. So I guess you'd have to ask them.
After the Great Recession, of course, there were extraordinary measures taken by the trio of Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson. And that was in response to what they had learned, ultimately, from the Great Depression, where we stood by and did very little. So why have those extraordinary measures not taken hold and really driven the economy forward in the last decade in the way that perhaps they might have expected?
Absolutely. The big deal, I think, in the U.S. was the failure of Lehman Brothers, but actually in the U.K. it was the failure of RBS. So what happened in the fall of 2008 is that central banks around the world cut interest rates and cut them fast. So I voted for interest rate cuts of 50 basis points, 150, 150, followed by 50 in four successive months. And then we went to quantitative easing. So that was the first thing. So monetary policy makers threw the kitchen sink at it. But at the same time, what happened was that fiscal policy around the world was also loosened. Gordon Brown organized the meeting of the G20, and there was a global fiscal stimulus. There was TARP, cash for clunkers, cash for fridges, tax cuts, all of that stuff. Okay. So we saw a really big recovery driven by monetary and fiscal stimulus. But then in around 2009, 2010, that stopped. So in the UK, we saw the introduction of austerity, big tax increases, big reductions in public spending. So the world found Keynes for about a year and a half, and then they bailed, and they didn't realize that the long-dragging conditions of semi-slump were coming into operation. And I think right now what's happened is that we're now in the position where monetary policymakers, when the economy appears to be slowing as it is, haven't got a lot of room for maneuver. They can't interest rates very far. They probably can't have the same bang for the buck of their asset purchases going on. And now what we're starting to see, we saw this from Mario Draghi last week in the European Central Bank. We saw it of the governor of the Bank of Australia saying, we have to get back to where we were in 2009, where we have to do things on the fiscal front. We have to start thinking about increases in public spending, reductions in taxes, because when this shock comes, which it appears to be doing right now, the central banks have nowhere much to turn. I mean, the UK interest rates are 0.75. In Europe, they're negative. In Japan, they're negative. In many places around the world, they're negative. So we've put ourselves in a position where we're extremely vulnerable to a slowing, and the answer is error, followed by error, followed by more error. And it's the fiscal guys who have to come and start to do something. But that's not very great news for the public listening to this podcast. It's these scary days.
Well, when you think about fiscal stimulus, and we know that Barack Obama really got criticized for trying to do too much, supposedly, though it was not the most dramatic approach that
right.
we could have taken. You look at the infrastructure bill that's been talked about. Going nowhere, evidently. We've got increasing piles of debt here in the United States. So what's the likelihood of any fiscal stimulus in the near term?
I think it's very worrying. I mean, the obvious one to go for would be that infrastructure bill, which looked a month or so ago that there was going to be agreement and Trump walked away from it. I mean, that would have a very big benefit in that you could put it in places that were particularly hurting. I mean, the concern in the U.S. is that could you actually pass anything through the Congress? Could you actually get a Democratic House to work with a Republican Senate? So that's the first thing. Go to the UK, which I know as well, which is that they are now they're fighting like ferrets in a sack about who should be the next prime minister. The prospect is that the Chancellor of the Exchequer will leave in the next couple of weeks. We don't have a credible government who can pass things through the House of Commons. And the governor of the Bank of England is leaving at the end of the year. So this looks very worrying. At least in 2008, around the world, we had credible governments. But the difficulty that Obama had in trying to get basically policy measures through the Congress is going to be repeated. And the economies are really it's concerning that they're going to be vulnerable to any slowing because the ability to pass these things and B, the understanding that the central banks can no longer be the only show in town is a concern. And the other one is that if you do this stuff, you're probably going to have to act pretty quickly. And the concern is that, you know, could any of these organizations act quickly? And the answer is probably not.
You write that right-wing populism has been driven by developments in labor markets and by failures of the elites to get economic policy right, and yet they have been focused on scapegoating in many ways, not necessarily the policies that you would
right.
see necessary. So they're scapegoating immigrants and others, and then they are looking at other ways to kind of keep everybody mollified who has a concern and has great anxiety about where we're headed. So what will the next response, perhaps, from right-wing populism be
right.
if, in fact, they are met with rejection at the polls going forward as they were in 2018 in America?
Well, it's obviously a big concern. I mean, I think what we've seen in this move to populism of Brexit and Trump is that people who felt a sense of hopelessness, they've been left behind in the recovery. Trump and Brexit offered somewhere to go, offered somebody to blame, the elites, the immigrants, the Democrats, the whoevers, Europe, the European Union. So in a sense, that explains the votes that we've seen. The explanation partly where we are is that, yes, times are tough, but Trump and the Brexiteers are trying to get things done. What's kind of interesting is the populists haven't actually delivered much of anything to the people who voted for change. We've seen in the U.S. in the last few days, 20 attorneys generals going to an appeals court to try and remove healthcare from 30 million people with no alternative on the table, with every prospect that that measure might actually take place in 2020, just before the election. So this is a quite interesting thing where essentially we haven't delivered much of anything. Wages haven't increased. There hasn't been much tax cuts for those at the low end. The question is then, what will happen if people don't deliver? Brexit, if Brexit becomes no deal Brexit on Halloween, then living standards and incomes are going to fall, and basically there's going to be economic chaos. Not clear that anybody really wanted that. So I think the issue going forward is, can these populists deliver at a time when economies are slowing? So if you look at the concept of Brexit, maybe it was a good idea, maybe it wasn't, but you couldn't have picked a worse time to do it as the global economy slows from a trade war.
We only have David Blanchflower for a few more moments, so I've got to get some definitions on the table or some explanations just to help anyone who's listening to understand what we're talking about. Labor market slack. You talk a lot about that, and explain that terminology and what kind of slack we have in the labor market today.
So what do I mean by labor market slack? What I mean by it is how much available labor there is out there for firms to hire. So a big impact on people's wages are how well firms are doing. The profits of the firm matters, but also the pool of labor that's out there available for them to use. So if you think there's lots of people out there, unemployment's high, there's lots of people looking for work, that's going to keep wages down. But as you move to full employment, the amount of spare labor that's out there becomes less. So I think of labor market slack as just how many people, how many hours are out there that firms can hire. The more of them that there are, the easier it is for firms to get them, the less the bargaining power of workers. The fewer of them there are, the greater is the bargaining power of workers, and the higher the wages are going to be for firms to attract workers. And if you're at full employment, that means labor market slack is really, really small, and the only way for firms to get workers is to get them from other firms, and the way they do that is by raising wages. So labor market slack has a great deal to do with how much people get paid. Wages are high when labor market slack is low, and vice versa. So it's sort of important. The example people have used is the unemployment rate, but it's not enough, because these days the unemployment rate doesn't give you a good steer as to what's going on. So we have to use something broader. I call it labor market slack. But that will include unemployment, underemployment, insecure employment. I mean, I sort of think if you get to full employment, the people who are really insecure and really worried about their work and not being able to get enough hours can actually get them. So labor market slack is a really important concept. It's better, I think, a better term than actually the unemployment rate, which is actually now not a very good indicator of anything.
And when we look at who's in the driver's seat today, without union representation in the private sector, with still a lot of slack in terms of people being underemployed, and we're not seeing wages really go up in any material way, so would we say that those who control business, those who are owners of businesses or managers, are still dramatically in control of the labor market today?
Right. I mean, I think that's a very good way of characterizing what we've seen in the labor market. Over time, globalization has increased. What does that mean? It means that firms can move abroad. It means that they can send work to India, or they can hire people in other countries, and they can bring in migrants. So that means that right now, the power essentially rests with employers, and they have the ability to pay. They don't need to, because they can replace workers pretty cheaply. So what happens is you move to full employment, which is, I talk a lot about it in the book, the balance of power shifts towards workers. And it means that then you start to see decent wage increases and the balance of power shifts. And the Great Recession scared workers, made them realize that the potential was to lose their job, lose their income, and it scared them. So the balance of power, you're right, has shifted very strongly towards firms, and it may not always remain that way, but obviously that's not great for workers who feel scared and underrepresented.
What about the division between what we're seeing on Wall Street and what we're seeing on Main Street? We're going to hear a lot about this, and that's why I want to ask you in advance of the 2020 election in America.
Sure.
Wall Street's doing great, but what about Main Street? So what's that divide about?
Well, in many senses, the divide is about the fact that you've actually got economic policy being driven by the central bank. So what have the central banks done? One of the big things they did is do what's called quantitative easing. They realized you couldn't cut interest rates low enough, so they had to start buying assets. But what did it do? Well, it increased the price of houses. It increases the price of stocks and shares, and essentially that's what's been going on. That's really helped people who owned assets. And so the stock market has risen. People holding those assets have felt pretty good, and many of them felt that Trump has delivered on that front. The problem is that people who've not owned houses, don't own assets, have not been helped. So there's the divide between Main Street and Wall Street. Yes, we see these record levels of the S&P and the Dow, but on Main Street, the ordinary person in Ohio or Alabama or Mississippi or Missouri hasn't felt those gains. And the big thing we've learned from behavioral economics is that relative things matter. So if I'm not doing well and you are doing well, I may feel better by you doing worse. This is the worry.
People are going to be hearing these terms, labor force, unemployment rate, employment rate, participation rate, and they're going to be bandied about in the coming election. What should people really focus on when they're hearing these economic terms bandied about? What should they really focus on and expect to hear that might give them a clearer picture of what's going on in the economy, aside from their walking about and feeling it for themselves?
Well, I think the last bit you said is really important. I think the economics of walking about means, the individual has probably got a pretty darn good sense of what's going on. They don't need to be told by labor economists or politicians how well they're doing. I mean, the big measure is, how are wages doing? How are your wages doing? Are you struggling to survive? Are you struggling to pay your bills, or are you not? So an unemployment rate is not a great indicator. I just think what's happening to your wages? Have you had a wage rise over time? Have things changed? I think that's the really good thing to think about, because each of these measures essentially are really about wages ultimately. So are you feeling better in the labor market? And are there decent jobs out there that you can go and get? Can you move to a decent, better paying job with more hours? And I think that's the story that the book says. You don't need to believe these deep technical terms. People know, and they should basically believe what they feel and see.
Well, let's go back to where you are. We know you're on a wonderful lake as we're speaking at this moment. You live in New Hampshire. The housing market, you said in the book, is slowing. You see a local store and a gas station closing. Are those better indicators than macroeconomic numbers? So when people walk about and they talk to folks and they say, how's your job? Oh, I just lost 10 hours, or I'm going to part-time, or my store may be closing. Is that what they should really understand and internalize as they think about their decision-making going forward?
I mean, the answer to that, if you look back in 2007, that's exactly what you should have done. What I saw around here in New Hampshire was that places were starting to close in 2007, and the housing market had really started to slow. Now, what am I seeing now? Well, the housing market has started to slow pretty fast, and Hanover, where Dahomet is, it's really interesting. Several stores on the main street now have closed. So stores on the main street have closed. The local Chinese closed. The bookstore, Barnes & Noble, moved out of Hanover. So Hanover is short of houses now. My local store down the road closed. I think this also says something which is quite interesting, which is that this state of New Hampshire, which has actually had a very, very low unemployment rate, as I say, its housing market is weakening, but it's one of the states with the highest opioid overdose rates. So even in this rural place, we're seeing slowing, and we're seeing economic and social consequences of people being left behind. So I think New Hampshire's a good place to look at, but it looks to me the similarities now in New Hampshire in this local place as to what happened in 2007-08, and especially it appears that construction spending's falling, the house prices, the growth has started to slow, and we've seen declines, as we saw in 2006 and 2007, in permits to build new construction. That should worry people. It looks like the housing market's turning down, and there are other indicators in construction and manufacturing and services that suggest here and elsewhere that this looks like the end of a very long boom, which has been a weak boom, and at the top of a boom, people are still hurting.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing some humanity to what some people call the dismal science. You certainly don't approach it in that way. David Blanchflower, the book is called Not Working, Where Have All the Good Jobs Gone? Thanks for being part of America Trends today.
Thank you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, MHNRnetwork.com.